could make a few comments, as Ken said, as to how the Yukon arrived at its present constitutional state, and suggest to you some ideas which you might find controversial or perhaps not, as to the part Yukoners played in this, because it's our contention that the Yukon's constitutional status was not entirely imposed upon them from without. They weren't entirely victims. They played a certain part in this themselves. Before I start, I'd like to give you a fact to mull over, and also a quotation. The fact is that the Yukon is one of two places that I know of in the English-speaking world, or perhaps in the Western Hemisphere, where constitutional rights were actually downgraded. That is, whose constitutional history was not weaved in school history fashion, up in hierarchies, as Lucy says in Charlie Brown, but actually went up and then went down. The other one, of course, is Newfoundland, which lost its dominion status during the Depression. This is, I think, a remarkable fact. The other thing I'd like to suggest at the beginning, or to tell you at the beginning, is a remarkable quotation made by a Canadian statesman a number of years ago, whom I'll identify later on. It's a kind of quiz and surprise for this. A Canadian statesman who said, quote, "It does not seem reasonable that the destiny of a territory as large as the Yukon should be finally determined by the few residents living there." Guess who? I guess it could be one of a number of people. The history of the Yukon constitution or constitutional arrangement, of course, dates back to the setting up of the Yukon Territory, and before that to the District of the Yukon. And before this happened, in the late 1890s, the Yukon was left pretty much alone by the federal government, even though it was formally acquired by Canada in 1870 as part of the transfer that brought Red River and Western Northwest Territories into Canada. It was, in fact, left alone for 25 years after its acquisition to develop a legal and administrative system of its own. Perhaps coincidentally, or certainly coincidentally, the acquisition of Yukon in 1870 was just about the same time when the first non-natives other than fur traders arrived in what is now the Yukon Territory to look for gold and to live more or less permanently. That is, the first miners, who came in the early 1870s. By 1885, there were about 200 of these people, most of them men, more or less permanently living in the Yukon, and by 1894, there were about 1,000 of them. And these people lived in a total legal and constitutional vacuum, because Ottawa paid no attention whatsoever to the Yukon. And so these people, as people will do in these situations, set up their own legal system, completely independent of any formal law. This was a system of ad hoc community-based law based on the institution of the miners' meeting, derived from the mining camps of the American West, particularly California, a civil and criminal system which determined not only mining regulations, set up the size of claims and so forth, but it also regulated social behavior and punished crimes. And this is something that worked very well in a small population, but it was based entirely on the American idea of direct community democracy and was presumably offensive to the British Canadian idea of law coming from the Crown. It worked this way, and I'm sure many people in the audience know this already. Any miner with a grievance could call a miners' meeting. Everybody who lived in the vicinity would come and hear the dispute, and the judgment was rendered by the vote of all present. This system seems to have worked quite well in practice, because the mining community was fairly small. The miners took a man's reputation. location into account in sentences where it were cut off and based on character as well as events, which sounds horrifying. Perhaps you will leave in mind, except that this was a community where everybody knew everybody else very well, and so the judgments, although very ad hoc, were generally considered to be fair enough. The usual sentence was either a warning or banishment from the community. And this went on from the late 1870s, early 1880s, we don't know when it started, right up until the arrival of Canadian authority in the mid-1890s. The Canadian government was moved to exert its authority over the Yukon only very reluctantly and under pressure. The reason for this was, as Ken suggested, that the Canadian government had other fish to fry which it valued more highly, such as the Canadian Prairies building the CPR. And although one doesn't want to make excuses for Ottawa, it is true that there was a very large territory to administer, and the population of Canada at the time of Confederation was only 3.5 million, and they had many, many tens of thousands and millions of these square miles to show the flag over. And it's perhaps not surprising that they came fairly late to the Yukon. But they came to the Yukon, as I say, only under duress. In 1886, there was a fairly substantial discovery of gold in the 40-mile district. And by this time, some of the more harmful aspects of this unregulated American frontier society were becoming apparent. Particularly, the effect of this society on the native population is becoming apparent. The missionaries in the region, who arrived not long after the miners, in some districts, were becoming concerned about the effect that the miners were having on the local Indian population, not only a certain amount of liquor and disease, but, although many native people avoided these by simply keeping away from the miners, but also the fact that the growth of the mining economy downgraded the fur trading economy. It meant that the local traders were more interested in serving the miners than they were dealing with the Indians. And the fact that by the middle 1880s there were several hundred miners in and around the 40-mile district, most of them Americans, finally persuaded the Canadian government at least to send somebody up for a look-see. And that was why in 1887 a party of the Geological Survey of Canada came up to report on conditions, and William Ogilvie determine the location of the Alaska-Yukon boundary in the 40-mile district. But it wasn't until 24 years after Canada had taken over formal ownership of the Yukon that Ottawa attempted to establish any kind of legal or de facto control over the region. 24 years of total non-government. The impetus continued to be complaints and suggestions from people in the north, particularly local missionaries, Bishop Office of the Anglican Church, about the treatment of the Indians, and suggestions and urgings from the traders that formal law and order be established. So it was the church and the, I guess you could say, the business community that finally prodded the government into coming up and showing the flag. And it was in that year, 1894, that two members of the Mounted Police came to the Yukon on a reconnaissance mission. The head of this two-man expedition, a man named Charles Constantine, was given the title of Agent of the Dominion Government, and he was empowered to act for the government. Wide powers, everything from Indians to mining, everything you could possibly imagine, while at the same time he was cautioned to rock no boats, not to offend the local people, and to spend as little money as possible. In 1895, the year before the Great Discovery, Ottawa sent a 20-man detachment to establish a post at 40 Mile. And the police, who were empowered to do everything you could possibly imagine, from being Indian agents to carrying the mail, to being coroners, to you name it, they had no difficulty at all in establishing their authority. They planted
planted the flag, they announced that British law was now to prevail, British Canadian law was now to prevail, that the miners' meeting was no longer to exist, these miners were to desist, trying to enforce their own law. They had no problem doing this. The miners' meeting was starting to come apart anyway, because it didn't work once you had so many miners that they didn't all know each other and have a certain commonality of interest. The incident which showed the police power and the new regime was a case in which a miner had leased his mine to another man, his claim, I should say, leased his claim to another man. The second man hired laborers to work it, but then he defaulted on payment of wages. This was the kind of thing that was fairly common in the California mining districts, and so the workers called miners' meeting, and the decision was to award the claim to them in lieu of wages, which was, you might think, was fair. The original owner, however, complained to the police. This was not in accordance with law. And the police sent a 10-man detachment to the claim armed with any metric rifles, told workers to clear off, and gave the claim back to its owner. The miners did not protest, and that, as the Inspector Constantine proudly reported, was the last time anybody tried de facto law in the Yukon. Quite a symbolic event, which took place in the year 1895. But the reason the miners didn't complain, and one wonders about this, since there were 20 police and there were well over 1,000 miners, most of them American by this time, many of whom either didn't know or didn't care that they were actually living on the east side of the 141st Meridian. The reason that nobody seems to have objected to this was that most of the miners seem to have been happy enough to have their society operated under a regular system of law and to have this rather ad hoc system replaced by law from a statute book. At this time, of course, Yukon is still not a separate jurisdiction, but simply part of the Northwest Territories, whose capital was in Regina. And in 1895, the Yukon was made a district of the Northwest Territory so that local officials could be appointed within a specific jurisdiction, so that one was a corps within the Northwest Territories, or within the Yukon district, or a justice of the peace, or whatever. And so all these officials were appointed. They were all bound to policemen. The justice of the peace, the magistrate, the mining recorder, the coroner. It's like something out of Gilbert and Sullivan. Collected the taxes, carried the mail, served writs. No doubt it was a smile so bland. But anyway, they were all mounted policemen who did double duty. The 1896 discovery and the subsequent rush, of course, swept the system away. When the population of the Yukon rose to nearly 40,000, the region needed an administrative system far more complex than the mounted police were able to provide. They needed to collect royalties and customs duties, a large postal and telegraph service, all the rest of the apparatus. And it was for this reason, and also so that the federal government could control the Yukon more tightly, that the Yukon Act of 1898 was passed. When I say more tightly, I mean things such as the fact that the territorial government of Regina got the idea of increasing its revenue by issuing liquor licenses in Dawson City, which it had the power to do as long as the Yukon was merely a district of the Northwest Territories. Ottawa did not want this to happen. This is one of the reasons why the Yukon was created as a separate territory, this and things like it. The Act created the territorial government in which the head of administration was, of course, a commissioner rather than a lieutenant governor. Why the federal government decided to make the head of administration in the Yukon a commissioner rather than the local representative of the Crown, I'm not quite sure, but it must have been mostly a question of prestige, and to make it even more apparent that the commissioner of the Yukon was a servant of the Department of the Interior, and it was in no way a kind of vice-regal representative of Queen Victoria in the far northwest. It had been recommended and suggested at the time that the Territorial Council had equal numbers of elected and
appointed representatives, but of course Ottawa rejected this idea and provided for a council under the Act of 1898, which was entirely appointed. This was the system which in fact prevailed in the Northwest Territories before 1875, and the reason it was applied to Yukon, of course, was the fact that a sizable majority of the population was non-Canadian, and the federal government had not the slightest intention of giving any form of local self-government to a district which was peopled by Americans, particularly the kind of Americans which one policeman called the scum of the West Coast cities, unquote. These are the people who came to the Yukon. In fact, if you read Sam Steele's 40 Years in Canada, which is a wonderful autobiography, Sir Sam Steele, that is, who's the absolute quintessential late Victorian soldier adventurer, had a wonderful career starting off as a boy militiaman at the Battle of Ridgeway in the Fenian Raids of 1866, went on through everything you can possibly imagine, RNC, the Red River Rebellion, the Mounted Police for years, the Boer War, the South African Constabulary, the First World War, got knighted, and so forth. Wonderful stuff. If you've never read that, it's a wonderful book. He doesn't call them the scum of the West Coast cities. That was Constantine, but he is equally unflattering phrases for Americans. And so they didn't give any kind of popular representation to the Yukon. The first Yukon Council was all appointed, and in fact, all the councillors were civil servants, federal civil servants. The powers of the commissioner and council were much the same as they were in Regina, except that the commissioner of the Yukon was given authority not only over the territorial government, but also over all the federal civil servants in the territory. And this was done for reasons of convenience, because the communications were so bad in 1898 that it took weeks to get messages and instructions back and forth. When better communications were established, of course, in 1899-1901, through telegraph, first to Skagway, then down through British Columbia, and this was no longer necessary. In 1899, the Act was amended to widen the court system. A judge is appointed, taking the judicial function out of the hands of the Mounted Police. And it's worth noting that in the early days, during the height of the gold rush, the police, Mounted Police, were the arresting officers. They were also the judges, though. They sat as magistrates. The appeal was to British Columbia, but that had caused a great deal of difficulty, so that they were the judges. They served as judge, arresting officer, and of course jailers, so that one found oneself in the hands of the Mounted Police from beginning to end, from the time you were arrested to the time you were sentenced to 3 months of hard labor on the woodpile behind the barracks. This undemocratic system provoked complaints and resentment from some sectors of the Yukon population. Resentment which was fueled by the problems of administrating a mushrooming community. For a time, of course, the government was in chaos. The gold commissioner's office was in a shambles, the post office was in a shambles. There were well-founded charges of corruption, which led to a minor series of scandals in Parliament. Post office workers taking bribes for quick delivery of mail, hanky-panky in the mining records, civil service speculating on mining properties. Often opponents of the system, some of the miners, some of the residents of Dawson, two of the Dawson newspapers, which were owned by Americans, agitated for a change in the Yukon Act to provide for election of members, and the conservative opposition in Ottawa took up this cause and lambasted the government, this is the Laurier government, for corruption and inefficiency. And in 1899, the Act was amended again to provide for the appointment of two members from the federal government, the election of two members from the federal government fit to do so. This was done in 1900. Two members were elected from the Citizens Yukon Party to the Territorial Council in 1900, but it's significant that this did not happen until the gold rush was over. The rush petered out in 1899.
by 1901, the population of the territory, which had been about 40,000, had fallen to 27,000. By 1911, it was 8,500. And most of the ones who left, it was assumed, were the turbulent ones, the ones that Ottawa feared and distrusted, the Yankees who believed in too much in democracy. And thereafter, the act was tinkered with from time to time. Particularly, the number of elected councillors was increased to 5 and then to 10. And in 1902, the territory was given a federal member of parliament. This went on, even though the population of the territory declined tremendously. And then in 1918, the federal government announced, without any previous consultation, to the horror of the Yukon, a local officer, but there would be no elected representation. Loud protests resulted in the reestablishment of the councillor, but the office of commissioner was not reinstated. Rather, the chief administrator of the territory was the gold commissioner, which meant that there was one official less. This apparently saved $150,000. And in 1928, the powers were transferred from the gold commissioner to the controller, who was a kind of chief accountant, who held the power, that power, until 1948. In the 1930s, there was a further purge of the civil service. It was at this time that Pierre Bergen's father was laid off as redundant. And this is what I meant when I said that the Yukon was one of the few places where the constitutional rights were actually downgraded, because the representative factor was very much reduced, and the importance in the very office of the commissioner was abolished. And if you read the records of Yukon Territory in the 1930s, you see that it operated on an almost unbelievably small scale, given the amount of cash flow that flows through government these days. It's amazing to reach George Jekyll, who was the controller for many, many years. His shrieks of joy in 1938, when Ottawa passed an extra appropriation of $5,000 so that he could put a few men to work on the roads. Dawson City had to beg Ottawa for money, and this money was reckoned not in the millions, but in the thousands, a few thousand dollars here, a few thousand dollars there. It was very, very parochial. However, having said this, and this state of affairs, of course, lasted until about 1950. In fact, the Office of Commissioner was not reinstated until 1948. Having said this, which sounds like Ottawa bashing, which is certainly another one of these northern outdoor and indoor sports that you're speaking of. Having said this, it seems to me, or it seems to us, that, as the Queen says, I mean my partner, but not the royal queen, it seems to us that the Yukoners themselves played a certain part in this. This denigrating of the Yukon's constitutional position. In the first place, Yukon's democratically elected representatives in the early days tended to show a considerable lack of political maturity and responsibility, partly due to local conditions, partly due to Ottawa conditions. The office of commissioner, for instance, was for many, many years a political plum given to well-connected liberals, and then, in the fullness of time, to well-connected conservatives. Ogilvie, Ross, and Congdon, who were the first three commissioners, were all liberal stalwarts, and George Black, of course, was the territory's most prominent conservative. F.T. Congdon, who was commissioner in 1903 and 1904, was a liberal lawyer who had come to Dawson in 1901 as a legal advisor to the territorial government, and he was a particularly notorious machine politician. And as commissioner, he built up a political machine by use of patronage, which on a small northern scale made Dawson City almost Chicago-like in its machine politics. He became involved in a quarrel with the residents of Dawson at one point, which resulted eventually in the revoking of the city's charter and the reinstatement of direct rule over the city of Dawson from the commissioner's office itself. It's a very complicated and interesting story, if you like sleazy politics. He himself resigned in 1904 to run for parliament. He's defeated, but he hung around for years and years and years as a kind of gadfly to bedevil Newcomb affairs. And I think we would suggest that the violent partisanship of Newcomb politics, and it was incredibly partisan, all you have to do is read the newspapers of that era, it hindered its constitutional development because it meant that Yukoners did not speak to the rest of the country with a very unified voice. In the old Northwest Territories before 1905, when Alcott is now Alberta and Saskatchewan, were trying to become provinces, there was a fair degree of unanimity and a fair degree of nonpartisanship. The politicians did not, to a fairly pronounced degree, spoke with a unified voice, didn't fight with each other. Councillors in the Yukon spent most of their time fighting with each other, and over very petty things, or perhaps it didn't seem petty to them, but who would be hired on the road crews and this kind of thing. And the more the pie shrank, the harder they fought over it, rather than speaking with a unified voice. And this was, we think, perhaps a major cause of the territory's constitutional stagnation, that is, the lack of progress towards responsible government. And the Yukon's members of parliament before the Second World War did not provide a very effective voice for the territory either. Messrs. Ross, Dr. Thompson, and even George Black, who was MP and his wife also, for many, 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 many years, did not seem to provide a very effective voice for the Yukon. The other factor to be mentioned, I think perhaps there's two, the other factor to be mentioned is the lack of commitment to the territory on the part of many of its residents, by which I mean its non-native residents, because, of course, its native people were entirely committed to the territory. In our research on this Princess Sophia book, which should be available at your local booksellers, I hope, in the summer sometime, we have discovered, and this is one of the most interesting things about it, because it isn't just a story of a shipwreck, it's a story about the Yukon and population movements, that a significant percentage of Yukoners were what we call sojourners rather than residents of the territory in the fact that they spent part of every year in the south, outside. Miners, business leaders, members of the territorial council, professional men and their families. People like Murray Eads, who owned the Alexandria Hotel, a.k.a. the Floridora, that's Ranchier days. People like Murray and his wife, Lulu May, who used to work for him and marry him. People like this took their money south every fall. He had invested in real estate in Seattle. And they seemed to have spent most winters in Seattle. The Yukon had two judges in 1918 in the Sophia Senate. There wasn't enough work for both of them. So they took turns, one year in, one year out. Law partners did the same thing. When the Sophia sank in October of 1918, the Anglican bishop was in Toronto on holidays, Bishop Strings. You heard about it on a train going to Toronto. The gold commissioner was in Nova Scotia. They too, like many other Yukoners, had seen the first hoar frost and had taken the steamer to Whitehorse and trained down to Skagway. And we would suggest that a great percentage of the Yukon's non-native population did not have a kind of commitment to the territory that would have compelled them to take the effort or to make a greater effort, perhaps, to agitate for greater political power or responsible government. And for various reasons, and I'm not saying Southern Fink Prof says it's all Yukon's fault. I'm not saying this at all. I'm simply saying that it isn't all one side. And for various reasons, the Yukon, constitutionally speaking, was in a sorry state by World War II, which is where the quotation comes in. The author of this quotation, the good gold star he knew, was Don Botello, the premier of BC, writing in 1937 on the suggestion, his suggestion, that the Yukon be annexed to British Columbia. British Columbia's Apropos Alaska Highway, Apropos Development, why? And this proposal fell through, not because the Yukoners objected to it, as most of them did, but because the Yukon gave public money to a Catholic school in Dawson, and in the British Columbia Catholic schools, separate schools were not supported out of the public treasury, and this would have caused a religious fuss. And so Mackenzie King dropped it like a hot potato because he knew a hot potato when he saw it. And it was at this time that Tullo said, "It does not seem reasonable that the destiny of a territory as large as the Yukon should be finally determined by the few residents living there," which has a kind of epitaph sounding about it, a more complete dismissal of democratic rights for Northerners one could hardly imagine. Then, of course, after the Second World War, we end not on a down but on an up note, things changed for the better, led by much more committed and more articulate spokespeople like Eric Nielsen, MP after 1957, and an increasingly vocal and committed territorial council. Things changed, particular demands for change, blocked at first, of course, by the federal government, anxious to develop the North at its own pace, as always, wary of passing on power to a small number of people, but the small number gets bigger and bigger. You know, perhaps, that the population of the Yukon at its lowest point, which is the 1921 census, was only 4,100. From 1,500 native people who were totally excluded from the political life of the territory. So it in fact doesn't leave very many people. And Duff Patello's statement was not as ridiculous as it seems on the face. Forward-looking Yukoners demanding greater autonomy, some arguing provincial status, others arguing against provincial status on the basis of cost, questions of ability of the Yukon to absorb responsibilities. And I want to conclude by giving one more quotation, this one from Joe Clark, the leader of the opposition, promising provincial status, but warning people that they ought to be careful what they ask for because they might get it. Thanks.
It is less true now than it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, it was better than it was 15 years before that time. But I think that whole process goes back to what I was talking about before, at the very beginning, about the attitude the kid is bringing when they come north. And many of you see within the government, for example, all sorts of people who sort of look at the Yukon as one of the best career builders in the country. Go higher faster than you can anywhere else in the country. When you get the expertise down, you go to the south, back to Toronto, or what have you. And still, until processes start changing, where people start looking at the Yukon in a very different perspective, then you're going to perpetuate that system. And one of the things I'll argue, going to be more moral, is that I think Beech Lake has actually done a great service to Yukoners for exactly that reason. It's forced people in Yukon to start asking the same kind of questions people in Alaska asked in the 1870s and 1880s. You know, what is going to happen? What, you know, those kind of questions, you're right, I think in the 1920s, they really were not being asked systematically. The power leaders and major leaders of the territory spent as much time, often as much time outside the territory as they did the blacks and residents in Vancouver for a while, for example. And the people the MPs were living in Ottawa for all these reasons. And it's very hard to develop a regional protest if you just don't care about the place as anything other than a place to get money. And I think as long as you're making money, which the Yukon, for those small number of people who were here, the Yukon did okay in the 20s and 30s. And in the 1930s, the Yukon did not suffer the same sort of economic downturn of other places, so, you know, just write it up. And it's not a very important issue, because if you're interested, you're not worrying about the place your children are going to grow up. You're worrying about the place you're going to live in next year. And it sets a very different set of agenda and a very different set of concerns. And it's interesting, I think even like the late 1970s, early 1980s, you kind of getting back into that sort of complacency in the constitutional matters. Remember when Joe Park came up here in 1976? And just after he came to the opposition, one of the first things he did when he came to the Yukon, the problems with provincial status. And that's been very popular for a while, but it's deep math. It cost too much. And he's sort of gone back down to the complacency. Each like forces it back on the table.
Just wondering through the history, and I suppose becomes more relevant to in the nearer history rather than past history, what the development of the economic rationale and the economic reasoning for provincehood. Presumably there is some sort of critical point beyond which provincehood becomes viable, and you mentioned the ability of the structure here to absorb the responsibility that would be devolved upon the province. Is there some kind of trend of facts or reasoning or whatever in that?
There is, and I think in fact when I was still up here in the 1970s when that debate first started, and the answer to that was people started doing something, a number crunching. It came out, I remember one year with a number of $8,000 per person in the Yukon. That's what the cost of your province. And whether that was accurate or not, that became almost a symbol. And boy, you want to watch an issue die fast. You throw around a number like that. And that's what the issue sort of, wow, that's a lot of money. Gordon Robertson's written a very interesting book, very controversial book, called Northern Provinces and the Shape of Gold, in which he does the mathematics far better than I've ever, than most people have put together. And says that, the fact that the mathematics of it are, in contemporary terms, unreasonable. But I think the issue is not one of provincial status. One is the opportunity to aspire to provincial status. I think that really is the issue of Beech Lake. The issue of Beech Lake is, people aren't clamoring for provincial status. They're just simply saying, how dare you shut the door? And I think the mathematics, are there. I mean, when resource control comes back to the territory, and if the territory imposes a realistic royalty structure and system on it, develops its own taxation system, expands it, and what have you, then the finances can be there at a certain point. But we have a country where most of the provinces haven't reached that point yet, but they haven't come back to be territory. So it's an interesting question in how you balance back and forth. I think it's very instructive of the way the Yukon operates, so that issue is often front and center. Because for people who are here for the good times, not for the long time, not for the careers of the building time, or not for life building processes, those financial considerations are of first priority.
Well, I was interested in your reference to Duff Hallows, one other premier in British Columbia had eyes for the Yukon, and during the federal provincial discussions in the 1960s and the 70s, Premier Bennett, W.A.C. Bennett, would go, as everyone probably recalls, armed with his lovely maps of the country and to support his vision of the five region approach. And the Yukon was colored the same color as British Columbia. And he was quite explicit that he thought that that was a logical and a good thing to do. And perhaps the Prairie provinces as well would extend their boundaries northward. I wonder, have there been other, can you say anything more about the frequency, if there have been other times at which that theme has recurred in British Columbia?
I don't know whether concrete proposals have ever been made except before Patello.
The interesting thing with both Patello and Bennett is that both of them were Northerners, and both of them started their political career, and Patello, of course, was from Ontario, but Patello came to the Yukon and was in with a lawyer in Dawson City and an administrator in the city and what have you, and then went down to Prince Rupert. And his vision of the Yukon being what was a part of the East Columbia came from that. W.C. Bennett was in the Peace River country before he went down, became part of that whole process. And I think it's very instructive that it's two Northerners who sort of see the potential of the North. Whereas, most of our political leaders in British Columbia tend to come from further south. And so the concrete proposals haven't come in that way. But the other interesting thing is watching the proposals to sort of take away the Yukon from the top, rather than from absorbing it altogether. In 1935, there was a proposal, one of these wonderful things with these guys sitting down in Ottawa, four guys sitting on the table and said, let's plan the Yukon, let's plan the history of the North sort of thing. And they said, well, why don't we lop off everything in the Yukon north of Dawson City? And they think, well, that sure makes things administratively convenient, because then the Northwest Territories regulations and stuff apply to Herschel Island and apply to sort of Old Crow's easier to get to from Fort McPherson than it is to get through from Dawson City. And one of the people said at the time, he said, listen, Yukon's not complaining, they don't give a fuck, they don't care. Take it off there, they don't mind. And what is interesting is, again, it's hard to know how right or how wrong that point is.
Is it not true that the Yukon territorial government for many years Herschel Island is part of the Yukon.
Well, I don't think anybody did. The federal government certainly did, because the question as to why Herschel Island wasn't one of the other Arctic islands. And it's an interesting process watching that, because the Yukon simply hasn't grabbed onto those symbols the way you would have thought people would have. To a certain extent, 1918. But if you read all the material going back in 1918 when the Territorial Council was going to be abolished and then sort of brought back to the two representatives, and the total almost wrong. It's not sort of reunite our rights as Canadians, please. There's not that sort of emphasis on the symbols, i.e. the physical integrity of the place or the integrity of the territorial council.
In the way of a supplementary, has there ever been, any significant body of support in the Yukon for joining British Columbia? Or has it all been Southerners looking north?
I think it's all been Southern generated. At the time of Patello, the Yukoners were certainly not in favor. It would presumably destroy what civil service there was. It's sort of like maritime union of people. It would just become a complete backyard. And Bennett, I suppose, would arrange for the Yukon to pull the guy away. Peace.
Yeah. You were mentioning earlier that there was no formula that you can buy into in terms of becoming a province. I'm wondering though, one common characteristic seems to be that from time to time, when the people of a particular district decided or felt that they should become provinces, they then negotiated with the federal government directly. And what Meech Lake seems to have done, and the constitutional amendments seem to have done, is to have suddenly said that no longer applies, that the provinces now have some say in who becomes a province, and it's not just a simple negotiation between a group of people and the federal government. I'm wondering why that shift would have occurred.
I think that's a good point. I remember in the 1970s, when this issue of provincial status of the Yukon came up, that Pierre Trudeau's response was, not in my lifetime, which had everybody quickly checking their his birth certificate. And I think, you know, that was the plot all along. And the issue first came up in the 1960s, and when Ken McKinley was running around with a lot of his, you know, autonomy provisions, autonomy proposals, let's do this and let's do that. And the assumption was, in fact, that this was something the territory had to deal with the federal government. Now, the problem for the territory was there was no indication of, you know, if you achieve a certain financial stability, then you can do this. If you achieve a certain population level, then you can do this. I mean, those certain guarantees, there weren't those benchmarks that Yukoners could judge against. There was this assumption that it was between the region, the peripheral district itself, whether it's the Yukon or Nunavut, and the federal government to decide. My sense of the reason for the change in Leech Lake, Dr. Schwartz, who was supposed to be here, has very interesting comments to make on that, and there's some observations, is that, I mean, the North Pacific was discussed apparently in 15 minutes. You know, the fact that it was almost a throwaway issue, there is no issue, the question is, well, why not? And one of the explanations is the potential that other provinces, in fact, have their eyes on other parts of the North. That's a physics observation here. That's why everybody else is sort of saying hands off, because, you know, Quebec, Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Ontario, perhaps, have their own agendas with regards to that. I think that, you know, the simpler explanation is to be found in that 15-minute time period. There's something incredibly symbolic about the ability of a constitutional process to dismiss an area that is really responsible for this country's self-image just so quickly. It's because, in fact, the North, to most Canadians, is a mythology rather than a reality. And I suspect that's how come you can go ahead and say, well, how did this happen? It seems incomprehensible. But it is comprehensible if you look at it back and say, this is the attitude that Canadians, not just the politicians, federal or provincial, a group of people, but Canadians generally have toward the Northland.
Yeah, and sure, it's also true that the precedents for becoming a province are a little unclear. I mean, Manitoba became a province when Louis-Riel forced MacDonald to make them a province. And Alberta and Saskatchewan became provinces after quite a number of years of squawking to Ottawa, when they had a population of 750,000 between them, a number of years after you thought they would become provinces. So that each case was unique. And there presumably is really no precedent as to how it's done. I mean, except that it's a deal, as you say, between the territories and Ottawa, but the mechanics of it are sort of uncertain, or the right time certainly is certain.
Certainly no precedence in terms of criteria.
No, that's what I mean. There's no precedence for criteria. It's Alberta and Saskatchewan had a huge population, they became provinces.
And of course, when Joe Clark was elected, he had made very clear promises. And when he came up here in 76, he said within 4 years of becoming prime minister of this country, which for a whole bunch of reasons didn't happen, thank God. You know, that he didn't have the opportunity to bring forward that proposal. But I mean, that was a very clear promise. And then you could see a situation where the constitutional future view can't get turned on its head overnight, which is a political change. Meech Lake, of course, says, you know, that of course is out the window. Now you're talking about 11 political careers instead of one. And I think, you know, we can talk about this later on, but I mean, but for all intents and purposes, constitutional change in Yukon territory is absolutely dead. Not just in our lifetime, but in many, many lifetimes under the current structure of Meech Lake.
If Meech Lake dies,
I think we should declare ourselves a problem. Use the Tennessee format. I think the issue again is and you guys know better than I, but that is not what the Yukon's asking for. I don't think if you sat down and said, you know, should we have a constitutional form or create a problem right now and go on this way, that isn't the issue. The issue is the right to expect our full rights or Yukoners' full rights as Canadian citizens, whether it means appointments to the Supreme Court or the selection of senators or the right to aspire to responsible constitutional change. Meech Lake forces that hand.
It's not a lot to do with the change in the federal provincial relationship, and whereas there is no longer sort of a central government dictating, even on a Trudeau dictating what's going to happen and so on, it's actually 10 premiers who are dictating what's going to happen. So there has been a shift in federal, in the provincial status within the Constitution.
And if you were living in British Columbia, you'd be horrified at that prospect. I mean, for greater provincial power for premiers and stuff. It's disconcerting. And I think that's true also. You have to remember, too, that's also something that goes in ebbs and flows in Canada. And that, you know, we've had times when our provinces have been stronger and the times when our provinces have been weaker. And there are times of the depression, the federal government, the provinces transfer authority and stuff back to the federal government. And one suspects that, again, those ebbs and flows will come and go. But the problem with Leech Lake, if it goes through, is that it ossifies, which is exactly what provinces want, that kind of a structure. And I think I've heard it said many times by Native leaders, very concerned about the prospect of an Aboriginal jurisdiction becoming one of the partners at the First Ministries meeting, which would really throw a rather different perspective on how this country operates. And is it kind of the way it operates now?
Okay, I think we'll take a break now for 15 minutes. There's coffee and other refreshments out in the hall. There's those who want to ask more questions.